Welcome to the Perry Johnson Registrar's Food Safety Inc. podcast, where you can expect the latest news and discussions relevant to both the food safety industry as well as cannabis and hemp. Today's episode is a previously recorded webinar. If you would like to tune in to our upcoming webinars, visit our website at www.pjrfsi.com/webinars or give us a follow on your favorite podcast app. Thank you for tuning in.
Good morning, everyone, or good afternoon, depending on the time zone you're joining us from. And welcome to today's webinar, Allergen Management, Learning from Recalls. My name's Amy. I'm a member of the marketing team here at the Perry Johnson Companies, and I'll be here to offer some help and technical support to our speakers. Today, we are welcoming Dr. Stephen Gendel, the principal of Gendel Food Safety LLC, to the presentation, and I'll be introducing him to you momentarily. All right, but now I'm going to go ahead and introduce our speaker today. That's Stephen Gendel. He has over 30 years of experience helping to protect food safety and integrity, with over two decades of that spent with the FDA Center for Food Safety and Applied Nutrition. He was the very first FDA food allergen coordinator. In addition, he worked on agency policy, guidance documents, and regulations at the FDA. He is an internationally recognized expert on food allergen management and on safety assessments for new food proteins. Stephen, welcome to the webinar, and thank you so much for taking the time to join us. I'm going to give you control of the slides, and you can take it away whenever you're ready.
Well, thank you very much for that introduction. Just as a sound check, am I coming through okay?
Absolutely.
Great. Thank you all for everybody for joining us today to hear about food allergen control. I do want to emphasize or re-emphasize the idea that I'm really interested in hearing your questions and being able to talk about them at the end and see whether I can help answer as many of them as possible in the time that we've got. Let's see, that's not advancing. Let me click that again. There we go. And I won't go through this again since Amy has just covered it, but this gives me a chance to make sure that I can advance my slides. So let's talk for a while about the nature of the problem that we're discussing today. And the basic leading piece of the problem with allergens is that undeclared allergens have been and continue to be the leading cause of food recalls in the US and in many other countries around the world. The number of these recalls is greater than the number for Salmonella, for E. coli, for Listeria, for any of these other causes of food safety problems that people spend a lot of time thinking about and regulatory agencies spend a lot of time thinking about. The consequences of that are kind of worrisome, I think, because it means that sensitive consumers are still at very high risk of exposure to allergens that could provoke serious reactions. And the situation has not changed significantly in the 16 years after the Food Allergen Labeling and Consumer Prevention Act became effective. There was a agreement or general recognition that these consumers had a problem and had a great deal of risk, and FALCPA was passed to help them cope with that. But we still see a lot of recalls and other labeling problems that suggest that there's still a tremendous amount of risk even 16 years later. On top of that, when the Preventive Controls for Human Foods rule was issued and became effective, manufacturers should have had effective allergen controls in their food safety plans under that rule. But it's become clear that many manufacturers still do not. They still don't understand the nature of the problem, and they are not putting efforts into controlling allergens in an effective way. And I want to emphasize the effective there. I'm sure that many of them, if not most, have allergen control programs, but clearly there would not be such a high number of recalls and other problems if everybody was being effective in their allergen controls. And finally, one of the other things which has triggered a renewed interest in food allergens and allergen controls is the addition of sesame to the U.S. list of major food allergens. This increases the number of companies that have manufacturers that are covered under the rule that have to deal with food allergens and have to think about how their allergen control programs are going to work. So I want to spend some time, and probably the bulk of the time in this talk, going over some information that talks about what I call the shape of the problem, really describing what's happening in a way that will help us to understand why this is a problem and what we should do about it. So the first place I want to start, since we are talking primarily about allergen recalls, is with a little bit of history. This is a history of allergen recalls for FDA-regulated foods. Much of what I'm going to talk about today is for FDA-regulated foods. The principles apply for all foods, including USDA, FSIS-regulated foods. But for simplicity and for time today, I'm going to concentrate primarily on U.S. FDA-regulated foods. From 1913 to last year, there's been an average of 143 recalls for allergen-related problems per year. And this graph shows the percentage of all food-related FDA recalls that are caused by allergen problems. I displayed this as a percent of total recalls because of the potential effect of the changes that happened during the COVID pandemic. There was a reduction in the total number of recalls. Obviously, FDA activity in the field was reduced. So to look at the absolute numbers without having to do a lot of hand waving about the COVID dip, I wanted to present here percentage of recalls. Interestingly, there is a slight dip in 2019, which is before the COVID problems affected recalls. So you can see that during the last couple of years, the number of percentage of FDA recalls that are caused by allergens remains high. So historically, there is no sign here of an improvement. There's no change that says that we're getting our hands around the problem and that things are getting better. This is a slide which talks a little bit. I wanted to present some information here about what foods are involved in those recalls and what allergens are the ones that are most commonly involved in recalls. So the foods historically and on a continuing basis are bakery items, candies, and frozen dessert. The most common allergens, and this has been something which is again happening historically from year to year, is pretty much the same, are milk, wheat, egg, and what I've described here is multiple. Multiple means is a recall where the food is mislabeled for more than one allergen. And frequently it may be two allergens, but frequently or as frequently, it's three, four, five allergens that are mislabeled, many allergens. That's a very concerning situation when that happens. I want to again remind you that this is for FDA regulated products. Allergen recalls for USDA regulated products are a little bit more complicated because of the nature of the products that they regulate. Many allergen recalls there represent foods, meals, and other things like that that are multi-component foods that include meat, poultry, or other FSIS regulated products, and the allergen mislabeling can be present in those for many different reasons. Now, as I said, even though I'm concentrating on FDA-regulated products, I did want to share this from a paper that was published last year in Trends in Food Science and Technology, where they looked at allergen recalls, mislabeling recalls in general, from multiple countries around the world, included places like Australia, the Great Britain, I guess now it would be the UK, and Canada. And in that case, the most common foods were bakery, what they called meals, and candy. Meals are a category such as I was describing that in the US would frequently be FSIS regulated. But these are combination products that involve multiple foods and multiple allergen potentials in them, very, very complex things. And they were frequently the causes of recalls internationally, as they are in the US under primarily FSIS. The most common allergens, milk, wheat slash gluten, and tree nuts. I'll take a second here to mention that the reason why this is expressed this way reflects differences internationally in the way that allergens are regulated. In the US, gluten, as in gluten-free, is a separate regulatory situation from wheat as an allergen. So in the US, gluten-containing grains include wheat, rye, oats, and barley, wheat, rye, and barley, not oats. But internationally, many regulatory schemes combine all of the gluten-containing grains into one category, and all the recalls that are related to both gluten-free and wheat containing products are listed together. So that's why that category is higher and is different internationally than it is in the US. So what exactly happens, or why are there so many recalls, allergen related recalls? I thought that it would be worthwhile to take a few minutes here and look at some specific examples of recalls that are related to allergen labeling problems. And I want to emphasize that all of the examples that I'm going to use here today are from the month of October of this year. So I didn't have to go back more than just a couple of weeks to find multiple examples of the kinds of things that we're dealing with. We talk about allergen recalls. This emphasizes the fact that this is a real, ongoing, current problem. This is not a historical artifact. This is not something which we're looking at the past in order to think about the future. We're looking at today and at problems that are happening now. So with that said, let's look at these specific examples. The first one is for a product that was recalled, and this here, the wording here is a direct quote from the FDA website of the information about the recall that was posted by the company themselves. So if you go to the FDA recall webpage, the information that they post there is actually written by the companies. So this is the company itself describing the recall problem. This is an example of one where they made recipe changes and added a allergen to their recipe and did not update all of their labels. So they had some products on the market that contained egg protein that was not on the label. Second example, this is, again, this is direct wording from the FDA website as written by the company. This is a package product where they had a gluten-free claim on the side of the product, but actually had allergen information on the label, which suggested that there was wheat in the product. So the label on the product contained two contradictory pieces of information, which of course is not good for consumers. Third example, this is a fairly typical example of some of the things that we've seen at FDA over the years, which is that an employee at retail looked at the cookies that they were stocking and realized that the cookies that were labeled was supposed to be one type were incorrectly labeled as something else. So in other words, the cookies were put in the wrong package and the label therefore failed to disclose the presence of the allergen. This statement is interesting for a couple of reasons, not the least of which is that this is a problem that was not discovered until it actually got to retail. And it was a retail employee who noticed that there was trouble. This is something which I think that in a preventive control environment should never have left the facility where the packaging took place. Finally, I think this is the last example. There's one more. So this is pretty simple. Again, it was a product where it was discovered that the product which contains soy protein was distributed in a package that did not explicitly reveal the presence of soy. And in a similar manner, this is a recall where egg protein containing product was distributed in packaging that did not reveal the presence of egg protein. So we have two examples here of products which were simply mislabeled. Actually, what's interesting is when you read enough of these, and we'll see some more of this in a couple minutes, you begin to think that you can see the handiwork of the various lawyers or consultants who work with the food companies when these things happen, because the wording on these gets very repetitive. And I think that that's, again, a sad commentary about how common the problems are, that you can begin to see things like that that are happening over and over again. So why do these problems persist? Why do they keep happening? Well, I like to think that probably some of it is because it's hard to prevent a problem if you don't know why it occurs. You can't stop something if you don't know what the reason is for it to happening. So that's why I'd like to emphasize the fact that why a problem has occurred is every bit as important as knowing what the problem is. If you aren't really sure, then you can't have effective prevention in the future. You can implement prevention, but you have no way of knowing whether the problem has really been solved because you don't know what the underlying cause is. The way that I think is worthwhile to think about it is to sort of repurpose the concept that's in the FDA's preventive controls rule to think about not known and reasonably foreseeable hazards, but to think about known and reasonably foreseeable failures of the food safety plan, or at least in this case, the allergen controls in a food safety plan. There are some good reasons for this, and we'll be able to understand them a little bit better later after some more of the information here in the talk. But I think it really emphasizes the fact that if you have a really preventive mindset, that this is a better way of looking at it than what a lot of people use when they think about allergens as hazards. It occurred to me not all that long ago, actually, that another way of thinking about this is to think about vulnerabilities in your allergen control system. So this is a concept which actually has come over from food fraud prevention and food defense efforts, where people realize that what they're dealing with is a system where looking at the statistics of a natural process is not going to work in protecting the food and food safety in the types of problems we're looking at. And I think that applies here to allergens. So instead of looking at the hazard and looking at it in sort of a statistical sense of where hazards occur and where they're known, to think about vulnerabilities in a food safety system. What are the things that can go wrong in the system and where can it break down? And then we have a better idea about how to go about fixing it, especially when we couple this thinking about vulnerabilities with information on what has actually happened in the past, what kind of system breakdowns have we seen. So if you've noticed, I've sort of shifted the discussion a little bit from a hazard approach to a systems approach. And I think that's an important way of moving forward in the future. So what I'd like to do is to go back and look at the same examples, the same recalls we just looked at, and to add some more information about what was said about the causes of these, and look at the shortcomings of that kind of information as it's presented in recall information today. So let's revisit those recalls. So the first one, which was the one about the changes in the recipe, said subsequent investigation indicates the problem was caused by human error of mislabeling. That's a remarkably uninformative statement. Obviously, there was an error of mislabeling, or you wouldn't have the recall. And I'm not sure why they would think that that was be caused by anything other than human error. And I'm going to come back to this probably later, but I think that it's important to say that when you have human error, you really need to think about why the human was able to make that error. What was wrong with the system that allowed that error to make it through the process and affect the final product? The second one. So this is the one where the gluten-free claim and did not match the product's ingredient label. And in this case, it says procedures are being put in place to assure that food safety issues are taken into consideration for the design and approval of all future packaging. Several important lessons being here. One of which is of course, asking the question of why weren't those procedures in place in the first place? Also, I'm not quite sure what it means by food safety issues are taken into consideration. I would think that food safety issues are more than taken into consideration, but are applied. And it's interesting that they don't say that they were going to go back and check other existing packages and labels to make sure there were no other mistakes. But I also do want to emphasize here the idea that allergen control starts way back in your processes. So these two examples show that you have to start thinking about allergen control when you start to design the recipes for your product, and when you start to design your packaging and labeling for the product. So allergen control is not just a function of production, not just something you need to consider when you're working to actually make the food on the assembly line. It is something which goes all the way back to the concept of the food itself and to the package and branding you're going to put on it. So even if these things are not required under a preventive control plan. Clearly, you cannot have good allergen control unless you start at the beginning with the idea of the product. This is the other one that I talked about with the retail store employee. Subsequent investigation indicates the problem was caused by a temporary breakdown in the company's production and packaging process. So I'm not quite sure why they think it was a temporary breakdown, and it certainly is not very informative as to what they mean by a breakdown. So it's clear that the wrong product was put in the wrong package, but it's not particularly informative as to why that happened. Similarly, in this one, subsequent investigation indicates the problem was caused by a temporary breakdown in the company's production and packaging process during a label redesign. So at least this one is a little informative. And by the way, you can also see what I was talking about when I talked about being able to see the styles of the people writing these notices. But again, why was this considered a temporary breakdown? Did they go back and look at all of their other labels and packages to make sure that they were correct? And again, I want to emphasize the fact that label design and redesign are important parts of your allergen control system. So it isn't just during production and packaging, it's actually during label redesign that you need to be careful. So again, emphasizing again and again and again that same point. Here's this one, the egg protein distributed in the package did not reveal the presence of egg. This is a bit different because this is a case where the product was being made by a manufacturer and different from the company that actually, whose name was on the product. And in this case, the investigation said the problem was caused by manufacturer's negligence on the production assembly line. An employee used the wrong ingredient while mixing the materials together that caused the issue. This one has several disturbing factors to it. I will go back to the systems approach to allergen control. Why was the employee able to use the wrong ingredient? Why was there no checks in place as to what was used and how it was used in mixing the ingredients together? So this is a really important one where you look at a system breakdown and ask what went wrong with the system in this case. This is one which I think a standard preventive controls approach would actually should have caught this, because it should be a control to say that the right ingredients are being used when you're making this product. The other point it's interesting to me to talk about is if the employee was mixing the wrong ingredients, then it was very likely that it affected the quality of the product itself. This is not going to be the product that the brand owner was intending to sell. And this raises an interesting question, because in this case, it was caught and became an issue because it involved an allergen mislabeling. But what if it had been a wrong ingredient that did not cause a food safety issue? Would it have been caught, and would the quality of the product have been compromised in a way that would affect the overall brand integrity, and which nobody would have any idea that it was happening or that this, how often this happens, because since it's not a food safety issue, there would not have been a food safety recall or a public notice or anything like that. So we may have a hidden issue in the whole industry of problems which are not seen because they don't rise to the level of requiring a recall. So I do want to say that there are other sources of information that you can use to figure out things that have gone wrong. I like to concentrate on recalls because those are the things that are most public facing, but you can get some other information from other FDA resources, one of which, of course, are the publicly published warning letters. There also is information available in 483s and other agency information. But I think that this is, for the purposes today, would be adequate. So three of them that I picked out from warning letters, and again, I did not have to go far back to get these. These are all warning letters which are were posted on the FDA website in the last month. Now, the posting is the end of a long process, so the actual problems were identified a while back, various times for each of these, but the public release of this in a posting was in the last month. So again, these are very recent ongoing problems. So one of them, your allergen control program did not adequately address the monitoring of labels. This is clearly a failure to have a system in place which controls putting the right product into the right package. Second one, your recall product is misbranded and that the finished product labels failed to declare a major food allergen, tree nuts. This one is an example of going back to what I said, where allergen control needs to be something which starts long before you get to the processing line, when you think about what's on your label and what's in your recipe. So this was caught as part of an investigation of FDA on site. The third one is very much an example of the kinds of things that go wrong in the HACCP program. The hazard analysis did not identify and evaluate the hazard of undeclared allergens due to incorrect labeling at the packaging step to determine whether it is a hazard that requires a preventive control. Now, obviously, the inspector and the agency would not have said that unless they had seen a problem that the company was not controlling their labeling. So this is another example of the fact that I mentioned earlier, that even though companies are required to have allergen controls and to consider allergens as hazards in their preventive control system, many of them have done it in some sense, but it's not clear that many of them have effective allergen control systems in place. So those are some examples. I could have given you dozens and dozens of them, and I could have shown you almost exactly the same problem happening over and over and over again for a decade. So it's clear that the system has a problem, that the industry needs to think about this differently. So what can we learn from all of this? What are the take-home messages from what we've seen here so far? Well, the first one is allergen sanitation is not enough, and neither is allergen testing. And I want to emphasize this because there has been a tremendous amount of thought and discussion and controversy in some ways about how to go about doing allergen sanitation and how much sanitation is enough, and about the use of things like ELISA kits and swabs and so on to validate or verify testing. And I want to point out that the examples that I've shown and the vast bulk of the recalls we looked at that you can see on the FDA website over the last decade and in the warning letters that you can see do not involve the kind of cross-contact issues that you get from sanitation failures. Now, there are some particular food types where allergen control in the processing of the product is itself very difficult and can be quite challenging. I, as an example, use things like a chocolate enrober from a facility that handles both milk chocolate and non-milk chocolate, or a enrober in a facility that handles products that have tree nuts and peanuts in them and products which don't. This is a system where control can be quite difficult and where sanitation issues can be quite difficult. Another example might be in a facility which uses pasteurizers to pasteurize milk-containing products and fruit juices that are not milk-containing. Making sure that you've cleaned out the piping and so on is critical, and it's difficult to know whether you've done it because you can't see what's going on in these closed systems. But I think it's also really important to recognize that in many, many food products, in many systems, that simply sanitation is a baseline situation, and that allergen control requires a systems thinking that goes far beyond that. The next one is a check and double check. So many of the system failures that we see in recalls and in warning letters come from the fact that things happened, but there was no actual check on what happened in the process. And I think that it's important to recognize that when we talk about checking and double checking, that does not mean to just check that the paperwork was done. It's important to actually look at what is being done with materials, and then to make sure that the records reflect that, but not simply to check that the records are there and they're complete. So records are notoriously inaccurate. They can be problematic. They can be completed inappropriately or inaccurately. So I think that it really pays to think about when you're making food that you're dealing with basically with molecules, with stuff, with material, not with information and records. So think about that when you think about systems failures and understanding what can go wrong. Learning from others. So again, because we're talking about a situation where if you think back at all the examples that we had earlier, it all happened because somebody did something that was not the way it should be. I'm not going to say they necessarily made a mistake, but the system failed. The system made a mistake. And if you're designing a good allergen control program, it really helps you to understand what went wrong when others had problems. Of course, the trouble is that many times, if not almost all the time, companies don't do this. They don't understand or tell people what they've learned about their own failures, so it's really hard for you to learn from theirs. So the take-home lesson on that is do the best you can to look at what others have had problems, look carefully at what they've said and try to read into it some interesting lessons, but learn from the others so that you can avoid having the same problems occur to you. Supply chain controls are critical. Again, this goes back to emphasizing the fact that allergen sanitation is one part, but clearly not enough. There are lots of examples that the FDA has seen, that other agencies have seen, where companies are not aware of changes that happen with their suppliers and therefore miss the need to change their labels or they have label problems. I've been talking about this for a number of years, but I think that people have become really sensitive to the importance of supply chain controls over the last couple of years when we've seen so many stresses, so many changes, so many problems with supply chains. And it's important to recognize that when you're scrambling to try and replace a supplier, when you're looking for supplies that are short change, ingredients or other inputs, that you need to think about the potential for those inputs or supplies to have an allergen problem. That it isn't, your suppliers need to be carefully looked at. The materials that are coming in need to be carefully looked at to make sure that you are not creating an allergen control problem every time you need to switch. And it's part of that goes back to the fact that your broker is not really your supplier, that you need to know who actually produced the product, where in the supply chain people have checked to see whether it has allergens in it. Same thing also applies in this case to microbial controls. It also applies to food fraud, that you need to be really careful about your supply chains, especially in a world where you don't know tomorrow where your supplies are going to be coming from. Also, and I made this a separate slide because as you can tell, this is something that I feel is very important and that people need to think about a lot. But labels are part of your safety program. You need to very carefully think about controlling what are they supposed to say, what do they actually say, and where and when are they used. All of that is part of your allergen control program, and that is beyond what needs to be done in most HACCP systems, preventive control systems, which are focused on what happens in the plant floor, except perhaps for the last one of these, which is controlling where and when they're used. But allergen control is a bigger system than simply what happens on the factory floor. So pay attention to that, learn from the mistakes that others have made. A few more thoughts on what you as a manufacturer should be doing or should be thinking about doing. So the first one is to emphasize the concept of mitigation. You have to prevent allergens from getting into your supply chain or into your products because you can't mitigate them once they're there. This is not like, to take an example, salmonella, where you can subject the product to a kill step and have the problem go away. Once allergens are in the system, they are there to stay. So you need to prevent them from getting into your products and affecting your consumers and your customers. This means having good supply chain controls, as I just talked about before. It does mean have good allergen handling practices in your facility. Know where the allergens are, know how they're being handled. Codex has a very good guidance document on this. FDA will hopefully sometime soon be coming up with their guidance document. So be sure that you have good handling practices, and to be repetitively redundant, make sure you have a really good label control system in your facility. The other one that I've talked about and I want to emphasize again is don't settle for the easy answer when things go wrong. If you have a problem or you're aware of a problem or a potential problem, don't just accept the first answer that comes to hand. Don't just say, oh, the employee made a mistake or the wrong packaging was used. Ask why. Get to a root cause that really understands why things have happened. Some of the cases that I've seen, companies will tell the FDA, the employee did something wrong, so we're going to go ahead and retrain everybody. Well, if everybody was trained in the first place, what was there a problem with the way that they were trained that they didn't internalize the message or it didn't get applied? So simply training people, again, it will not help things if the original training didn't work the way it was supposed to. As I say, something like if the records were not accurate, if the handling of the labels was not good, to say the employee took the wrong label material, the wrong packaging material out of inventory. Well, then why was that possible? Where were the checks? Where was the system that would prevent that from happening? So don't settle for easy answers. Do really good root cause thinking to make sure that you really understand when things have gone wrong, and apply your thought processes in a concept of thinking about vulnerability of what could go wrong. Learn, teach, and share. This is something which I hope we can get to in the food industry much more than we have in the past. But information is important in learning for everybody in the system and for supporting improvement. So it really would be nice if we got to a place where everybody felt that the concept that safety is not a competitive thing really could be institutionalized and implied in a way that allows us all to learn from each other in a really clear and useful manner rather than in broad generalities, which really don't help you solve the problems that you have in your own facility. A few other thoughts. The addition of sesame, as I mentioned, to the major food allergens. So one of the things that's written into all of the regulations are that you need to do a reevaluation of your preventive controls or your HACCP plans or whatever when there is an event which suggests that something significant has changed in the system. So the addition of a new member of the list of the major food allergens is the kind of trigger that should get you to do a complete reevaluation of allergen hazards and controls in your system. It's a great reminder of the fact that once you have done the initial evaluation, the hazard analysis and control system, it's not a finished process. It needs to be redone periodically and thought through carefully. And this is a good trigger to make you think about it. So think about your supply chain issues. Think about your labels. Think about your recipes. Have you made changes? Have they changed the contents of your foods? And do you need to really rethink your whole allergen control system? There clearly are going to be certain kinds of products, and I will use bakery as a great example, where this is going to be a lot more impactful than in others. But it is a trigger which everybody who has any kinds of allergen control can use as a reason for doing a rethink. And also, I just added yesterday, because of the brand new final rule on traceability that FDA has just issued. I'm not sure whether it's actually published yet in the Federal Register or just been put on display, but in 60 days, approximately from today, it will become effective, and the compliance date is 3 years from now. But it's going to be a remarkably impactful rule as things go forward. My first read through of this suggests that traceability is going to intersect with allergen control in some really interesting ways. The example I have here is that the list of foods that require to fall under the auspices of this rule includes nut butters. Both peanut and tree nut butters are on the list that FDA calls the food traceability list. I didn't realize, thinking about it until today, that the effect is actually much larger than that. So, for instance, there are a number of different kinds of cheeses, in other words, milk-containing products, which are on the list. There's shell eggs, so eggs is an allergen, is on the list. There are fish on the list, so seafood is one of the major food allergens. Crustaceans are on that list. Crustaceans are among the major food allergens. So there is a lot of interesting overlap between the foods on the food traceability list and at least some of the major food allergens. I think that it's important to think about whether you are covered by this traceability rule, but I think it's also important to recognize that it's going to have an impact far beyond what I think FDA originally planned, but it is going to intersect a lot with our allergen control systems. So I mentioned this before, when you're doing monitoring what's going on in the facility, monitor what's actually happening. Don't just monitor the paperwork. And there's very little that will change in terms of allergen controls and the problems that you face in allergen controls if and when there are regulatory thresholds for allergen cross-contact or standardized advisory labeling like may contain. And the reason for that is if you think about all the examples that we had today, and I mentioned that before, they don't represent failures of sanitation. They don't represent failures of advisory labels. They really represent major problems. It isn't a matter of, you don't need a regulatory threshold to decide whether or not an almond cookie that's not labeled as an almond cookie is a hazard. It's a hazard. So the problems that we have here of systems thinking, of systems failure and vulnerability thinking are all going to persist if and when these issues are dealt with, despite the fact that industry has been looking for solutions in these areas since FALCBA was created. I think that we need to think about the problems we can solve now, because there's certainly plenty of them, and there's certainly a lot that can be done now. So with that, I will put up my contact information. I'll be glad to talk with anybody about their specific issues or problems and to help you in any way that I can to make sure that you're making products which are going to be safe and useful for allergic consumers. And with that, I will turn it back to either Chris or Amy to talk. We can do some questions and answers.
Thank you so much, Stephen. Yeah, we do have Chris Reno. He's one of our project managers at PagerFSI. And Chris, I know before we started the webinar, you'd said that there were some questions you wanted to ask Stephen.
Yeah, absolutely. And thank you so much, Dr. Gindel. What a timely presentation with everything we've got going on with the final rule just coming out yesterday and some changes. So I want to go back to one of your really early slides. It talked about gluten and cases where there's a U.S. standard kind of versus an international. So can you explain the why of a situation in which a gluten-free food might have a contains wheat allergen statement on?
So that was an interesting one. When we were writing the gluten-free rule, it was complicated. And it really goes back down to the way that FALCBA is worded, because FALCBA specifically makes wheat one of the major food allergens and requires the labeling for any foods where wheat-derived protein is an ingredient. But the gluten-free rule, which deals with the specific protein gluten, has a threshold level of 20 parts per million. So there are situations that can occur where you have, within the confines of the gluten-free rule, less than 20 parts per million, and you're entitled to declare gluten-free. But because there is some wheat protein present under FALCBA, but you do have to label that contains wheat. There is a way that's in the rule to put a little asterisk and a little footnote in there to explain that, but it is the result of just the structure of the rules, the laws that FDA has to enforce. And I mentioned that's quite different in other countries. So in those cases, these confusions are not going to exist.
So my second question, in looking at the graph, kind of year-to-year thresholds of recalls and the amount related to allergen-related recalls, notice that there was a really big jump between 2014 and 2015. Like we haven't seen, you know, really again, I guess 16 to 17. But do you think that that is the introduction of, you know, the FDA declaring new allergens? And do you expect, as we move forward, new allergens to be included on this list?
So, no, actually, that jump, I think, has more to do with the implementation of the preventive controls rule for human foods. I think that was it. I think that people, companies began to have to think about allergen control. FDA inspections began to, when looking at preventive controls, one of the things is that people were all trained on is that allergen control was an important part of the whole preventive controls program. So I think that those were finding situations that probably existed before, but that people weren't looking at as carefully as they should. I also think that there is, quite frankly, as you can see, a lot of what statisticians would call noise in the data. So I would not look at 1 year trends as being particularly significant. I like to look at this across the whole time span and to be able to say, things haven't gotten significantly worse, but they certainly haven't gotten any better either.
Right. Yes, sir. So that brings me to my last question. So we obviously saw some good examples of, warning letters and statements. Can definitely see what you were talking about, where the legalese kind of comes into it. You see a lot of very similar written responses to the FDA. How can you explain, I guess, very quickly, what would be the steps if we catch it? Let's say that it's caught in production correctly. Some product has gone out to redistribution center, you know, something like that. What is the easiest way to contact the FDA to let them know of a possible allergen recall?
So I'm going to take it from your question. You're talking about it from the point of view of a manufacturer. So if you are a manufacturer and you find out that your product is gone out with with mislabeled allergen mislabeling, the allergen mislabeling. The two things that you should do is report it to the reportable food registry and to reach out to your local district or regional contact person. You probably have somebody that you have worked with before in your region. If not, call their office and let them know. They're there to help you. So they will help companies navigate the recall process, the writing of the and posting of the recall notice, and the follow-up that's necessary afterwards.
Fantastic. Well, that's all that I have, sir. I'm going to go ahead and mute myself. I know that Amy's got a question from the audience, so I will bow out now. Thank you. Thank you, doctor.
Sure.
Thanks, Chris. Well, yeah, we do have an audience question here for you, Stephen. And bear with me while I read through this. The question is an allergen statement needed for a product sold prior to January 1st of 2023 containing sesame, which has a shelf life of 2 years?
So that gets to some interesting legal terminology. The actual law, and this is something which was written in the law by Congress, not a rule by FDA, but the law applies to anything which is introduced or delivered for introduction into interstate commerce after January 1st, 2023. So something which is already in interstate commerce does not need to have the label changed in order to meet this requirement, by which I mean, if it's in a warehouse waiting to get shipped or something like that, it should be okay. I will, however, say that you need to think a little bit about the allergic consumers. They are relying on you to give them appropriate information about the product. So if the product has an ingredient in it which has sesame and it's declared a sesame, but maybe isn't in a contained statement, That's one thing. But if it's missing altogether, is there a way that you can mitigate the risk to the consumers, perhaps by adding a sticker on the label or some other way of informing them? But under the law, it does apply to any products which are introduced into commerce starting in January.
All right. Hopefully that answers your question there. If anyone else has any questions, please send them in while we wait to see if anyone has them. I will remind everyone that the recording of today's presentation will be posted on the PGRFSI YouTube channel. That should be up by tomorrow afternoon, I would say. And the slides will be available as well from our website in the next week or so, once our webmaster comes back from the opening week of Michigan rifle hunting season. So if anyone else has any questions, please send them in. But in the meantime, Stephen, where do you see allergens as an issue going in the next 5 to 10 years?
Well, if we don't cooperate more and find a better way to reduce the number of mislabeled products and the number of recalls involved. Sorry, you did that. I think we're going to be in the same situation in 5 years. But I do have to say, you know, interestingly enough, given what's happened in the last couple of years, I think anybody who thinks they can predict what's going to happen in the next 5 years is pretty optimistic. The world changes a lot faster than what we think. I would say that one thing to look out for is that the food supply chain, we've really, really learned a lot about how complex it is, how fragile it is, how international it is. And I think we're going to develop a lot more awareness of the allergen issues that are involved in that kind of supply chain and those supply chain issues as time moves forward. Amy, are you still there?
Can you hear me, Stephen?
Yeah, I can hear you now.
All right. Sounds like we're just having some audio connectivity issues, but hopefully we can just stay optimistic, right? And everything works out better than it could. So Great. We'll just have to wait and see. All right. Stephen, I want to thank you so much for taking the time to join us. I don't see any other audience questions that have come in. So if you have a question, maybe you're a little too shy to ask it live during the broadcast, as Stephen said, feel free to reach out to him if you have other questions or need some support. If you're looking for other PGRFSI webinars or you want to know where to find the slides, please feel free to email us at pgrfsi@pgrfsi.com. Or if you go to our website, there's a phone number, other ways to find information. And I would encourage you all to speak up, reach out, get that info, and have a good next 5 to 10 years in the allergy world. But as for that, we're going to wrap things up for today. Stephen, thank you. Thank you, everyone in the audience, for attending. And we hope to see you on the next webinar.
Well, thank you for inviting me. And I wish everybody a safe and happy Thanksgiving.
Absolutely. Stay safe and stay healthy out there, everyone. Bye-bye.